This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What does it mean to be an Asian American in Michigan? How did immigrants from so many different Asian countries come to this state? And what does it mean to be the children and grandchildren of those immigrants? Those are just a few of the questions explored in the new book, Asian Americans in Michigan, Voices from the Midwest. And they're questions worth exploring. From 2000 to 2010, Michigan saw a 39% increase in its Asian population, and that happened even while the state's overall population was shrinking. Editors and contributing essayists Sook Wilkinson and Victor Ju are with us now. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Victor Ju, you wrote that this is the first book to collect a large number of contemporary Asian American voices in the Midwest. Why is it that the Asian American Midwest hasn't really been explored before this?
You know, so many people assume that Asian America is just on the West Coast. They think it's only a Washington, Oregon, and California story, and specifically a California story. So the assumption is there's no Asian America east of California, but that's just a badly founded or ill-founded assumption. You know, once I told someone at UCLA that I was going to teach a class on Asian Americans and the Midwest, and she looked at me and she said, "Do you have enough material for more than the first week?" There is more than enough material for the first week and going into a semester. So I think it's just this assumption that there is nothing, but there is so much.
Sook Wilkinson, what was your personal mission statement? As you and Victor set about gathering essays and editing them and putting this book together, what did you want to accomplish?
We just wanted to tell the stories of the Asian Americans living in Michigan. It's, as Victor said, it's rather a unique set of stories, and we wanted to explore their history, their issues, and the joys in life here in Michigan.
And I know, Victor, when we talk of Asian Americans in Michigan, the diversity is unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, what kind of regions and countries are we talking about?
Well, you know, before World War II, it was always known that there were five major Asian-derived communities in the United States: Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, Korean Americans, Filipino Americans, South Asian Americans, Indian immigrants from northern India. And the Midwest had all five. The 2010 census, the last census, showed that in the Midwest alone, there are 19 different Asian-derived communities. And so add to the five that I just mentioned, more of South Asia: Bangladeshi Michigan, Pakistani Michigan. Add to that Southeast Asian American communities: Vietnamese American Michigan, Hmong American Michigan, Lao American Michigan, Cambodian American Michigan. So think of 19.
That's something else. And you make such an interesting point early in the book that even the Asian Americans probably wouldn't have seen themselves as Asian Americans because there was no sense of unity. In fact, as you say, their ancestors hated one another. So did that make it easier or more difficult for these immigrants to assimilate once they came to the Midwest?
Well, you know, I'm always surprised by the surprises, Cynthia. And we know that before World War II and before the 1960s, there was no explicit Asian American studies or Asian American movement. But what I'm finding, these really interesting moments, especially in the Midwest, in Chicago and Detroit, where you have different folks: Japanese who are living in the Midwest, Chinese living in the Midwest, Koreans living in the Midwest, and they would gather together. They would gather together before World War II in the 1930s at chop suey restaurants in Detroit. Why? It seems that chop suey restaurants became this de facto Asian commons. And so there would be an Asian commons in various places. And so that's surprising, right? Because we tend to think, they must have kept themselves separate. But there are these interesting moments when they got together even in the 1930s and 1940s.
You both made really interesting points in the book that we would be surprised at the long history of Asians in the Midwest. How far back does that go? When did they first begin to come to the Midwest and to Michigan, Sook?
Well, in the Midwest, you know, there's a recorded history of people showing up from Japan, from Korea, from China and India and the Philippines and so on in the early 1900s, and even before that in the late 1800s. So, yes, there is a long history of them having been here in Michigan.
And how were they received? Was there tension as they arrived, or did they kind of, were they able to slip in and begin to set up lives?
Well, you know, I think because the numbers were so small, they did not attract a lot of attention. However, quote-unquote, the rest of the Americans were not used to seeing these people who looked so different. So there was some prejudice, curiosity, questions, but no big notable tension that I know of.
I'd like to take a moment and read a bit from the foreword by Frank Wu, who's the former dean of the Wayne State University Law School, and get your thoughts. And so here's what he wrote. My brothers and I were both the same as and different from our classmates. We wanted to be just like them, wearing popular sneakers, eating meatloaf, hanging out after dark, and watching cartoons on Saturday morning. We could not help being always conscious that we were different from them, wearing home-sewn clothes, using chopsticks to eat meals that looked disgusting to our peers, doing extra homework instead of playing outside, and attending Chinese school on the weekends. I'm wondering how Frank's childhood experiences square with what you experienced. Victor, I'll start with you.
You know, Frank grew up Chinese-American in Detroit, and I can identify with some of those aspects, chopsticks, Saturday morning cartoons, getting a sense of difference. My father was from China, came over in the 1930s, and my mother was from Hong Kong, came over in 1947 after the war, or actually 1946. But I also grew up in Los Angeles, and so that is actually very different. And I grew up in the Los Angeles Chinatown community, so I had a sense of many more Asians around me, many more, well, Asian Americans around me. And so that is a difference. But I can identify with Frank and with so many Asian Americans as far as things like food and bringing food that our mothers made and we loved, bringing them to school and people just looking at it really weird, as if it was really strange.
Mm. And Sook, I know you came as a young woman to teach Korean to Peace Corps volunteers, so you didn't go through a childhood here, but when you came here to America, what made you feel separate and not included?
Initially, I think the gap in terms of the cultural experience, I did not grow up with the American culture, so when people talked about and gathered about a particular experience that was totally new to me, there was some gap there. However, I saw it as an opportunity to learn about new things and learn about the American culture. And, you know, in response to your question, Frank's experience, I don't think, was all that different from what many younger generation folks in Asian American community are experiencing now. For example, in the book, there is an essay written by Lawrence Almeida, who grew up in Rochester, Michigan, perhaps maybe two, three decades ago. And he talks about how his first grade teacher decided one day to line up the students by what they ate for breakfast. Mm. And, you know, it's a really lovely essay where he talks about he realized as a first grader that the teacher was never going to guess what he had for breakfast. Oh. And how humiliating that was for him.
So hard, because all a kid wants to do is fit in.
Exactly. And then we also have an essay by Emily Xiao, who wrote the essay when she was in high school in Ann Arbor at Huron High School. And she talks about what's going on, what went on at that time at that high school. And, you know, she talks about things like Asian failing. What is Asian failing? You know, a lot of Asian parents really emphasize getting good grades and so on. So when you talk about Asian failing, it's like, did you get A- instead of A+ kind of thing? Yeah. And then how the teachers sometimes would look over the Asian American students with their hands up, thinking that, oh, they know the answers, you know, so I'm going to go to somebody else.
And just skip past them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Victor, you have an interesting point that you write about in the book about why you see it is that Michigan's Asian Americans have often been overlooked, because we tend to categorize by black and white in this state, don't we?
Right, and that's very much the racial discourse throughout the nation. When you have a race discourse that only focuses on black and white, then people don't know how to fit Asian Americans, and Asian Americans suddenly become lost in the conversation, lost in the discussion. I guess what makes the book really exciting for me is that it provides two things. It provides a resource of voices that were never heard, but we always sense that they were being spoken, and yet they were never listened to, especially in the 1980s. And the book also supplies a new storyline, a new overarching history story that shows how much Asian America and Michigan were intertwined. And so in some ways, it is a nice way to think about, think through, think past the black-white dichotomy.
I'm speaking with Sook Wilkinson and Victor Ju. They're editors of Asian Americans in Michigan, Voices from the Midwest. We can't talk about the 1980s without spending some time talking about something that happened on June 19th, 1982. In fact, the book that you have edited is dedicated to Vincent Chin, the 27-year-old Chinese-American man who got into a fight outside a strip club on Woodward in Highland Park where he was having his bachelor party. Sook, will you refresh our memories about what happened that night?
He was about to get married. So he and a few friends went to a strip club in Highland Park, as you said, you know, and they had a few drinks under their belt, and so were the other customers, and they got into a fight with two people, and, you know, one of them was a laid-off auto worker, and some ugly words were exchanged, and they got into a physical fight, and they got evicted from the club.
And just to remind everyone, one of the men was a Chrysler plant superintendent named Ronald Ebens, and he was there with his stepson, Michael Nitz. Allegedly, it was Ebens who instigated the fight, saying, quote, because of you, bleep bleeps, we're out of work. And after Vincent Chin fled, the two men actually tracked him down to a nearby McDonald's and beat him with a baseball bat. And he died after 4 days in a coma, didn't he?
Well, he died on the day he was supposed to get married.
So with all of that in mind, Victor, what happened in court?
I'm glad you mentioned Ronald Ebens being heard, actually being testified as having said, you know, because of you, mother effers, mm-hmm. we're out of work, which means something more was at work, right? Something
yeah.
more was at issue, was at stake. When Ronald Ebens looked at Vincent Chin and his bachelor's party, he saw not something he could identify. It was something he thought was actually a threat. He thought these Asian-looking people, Vincent Chin, Asian-looking person, was a representative of the Japanese automobile industry. And at the time, the Japanese automobile industry was seen as undermining the U.S. automobile industry. And so something more was at work. Because of you, mother effers, were out of work. Even though Ronald Ebens was still employed at the time, his stepson was unemployed. Also, in terms of the ways in which the Asian category kept traveling that night from Japanese to Chinese, because Ronald Ebens, as he was hunting for this person, he paid someone on the street $20 to help him find a Chinaman, help him find that Chinaman. And so Chinese, Japanese, it all got mixed up into something he did not like, something he felt threatening, and something he had to find and hunt. Now, what happened after Vincent Chin died was in many ways a kind of second dismissal. The first dismissal was Vincent Chin actually dying. But the second dismissal was in the courts, the federal courts, those who sought for some justice for Vincent Chin's legacy. The fact that the plea bargain for Ronald Ebens and Michael Nitz was 3 years probation, $3,000 fine. Many Asian Americans were outraged by that, especially the many different Asian-derived communities in Detroit, because they realized that Vincent Chin's life was cheapened, and they also realized that so many of themselves, their lives could be cheapened because they could be in a similar situation. So they sought a remedy in the federal courts, hoping to get some federal remedy that would recognize that Vincent Chin's civil rights were violated.
And how did this case unite Asian Americans?
Well, immediately in Detroit, you know, what's so great, Cynthia, I don't know if you know Helen Zia. Helen Zia wrote for Ms. Magazine. She was a journalist, but she was in Detroit in the 1980s. And she reported that there were so many different Asian-derived community organizations. There was a Chinese organization, a Filipino organization, a Korean organization. They never really got together as organizations, But because of the Vincent Chin incident, they did get together and meet, and they formed a new civil rights organization, American Citizens for Justice, mm-hmm. ACJ. And that organization still exists today.
And it was not only the organizations in Michigan, but the folks and the organizations throughout the country were outraged at what happened in the court system. And they literally came to Michigan to lend their support. And that whole experience awakened in all of us a new sense of Asian American movement. And, we're still part of that. That kind of movement is never over with. On a personal level, I was living in Michigan at that time with two young children, 1 and 3-year-old. Until that happened, I always saw myself as Korean American. I didn't know of any other Asian Americans at that point. But when that happened, I realized that when I left my house, my door, people didn't care whether I was Korean or Chinese or Japanese. It really didn't matter. They just saw me as an Asian woman. And I realized that Asian Americans really needed to come together and have our collective power so that we can get through situations like that and never let something like that happen again.
In the final moments we have, Victor, what are the opportunities and the challenges for Asian Americans in Michigan as you look through into the future?
Well, not just Michigan, Cynthia, but because I teach Asian American Studies here in Wisconsin, I'm looking at the Midwest as a large region overall. And I think the challenges would be an acceptance and a realization and a recognition that Asian Americans are not conditional, qualified local participants in Detroit or Cleveland or Chicago or Madison, Wisconsin, but Asian Americans should be recognized as are all Americans, as full participants, full local citizens. And so a kind of full, unconditional citizenship so that Asian Americans are not forever tagged as forever foreigners or something forever alien. So I think that's the big challenge, the continuing challenge today.
And your thoughts, Sue?
Well, my thought is along with what Victor said, but also I think we as Asian Americans really take charge of our own ownership as citizens of the residents of the state and citizens of this country and stand up for our rights and make contribution and celebrate who we are and who you are as well.
The book is Asian Americans in Michigan, Voices from the Midwest, and we've been speaking with the editors, Sook Wilkinson and Victor Jew. It was really great to talk with both of you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you very much.